Is mine on?
Yes, yeah. Yours is on. Do you want to ask them if they can hear, just to make sure that yours is working?
Can everybody hear me at the back? Yes?
More thumbs up. Excellent. I'd like to welcome our Facebook audience, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming out this evening. This is so exciting. This is Jim's 13th Sigma Force thriller. Now, is this a lucky 13, do you think? Come on, you have
I'll
to answer.
I'll let you be the judge of that.
But how many books is it, Jim?
33 total.
33 total.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. You were...
Everybody's doing the math in your head, aren't you, right now?
Right. Less 13. So 20 other books. Wowee. When did you start all that?
I sold my first book in 96, and it came out in 98, though. So 98 was my first publication, when Subterranean came out.
So you've really been busy, if it's 98 to 2017.
Two books a year.
Two books a year, right. And in various things, why, you know, you are a veterinarian, but you could have, in fact, written about anything. Why did science-based...
Poinsettias bugging me.
Sorry. Science-based thrillers.
Poison to dogs, be careful.
Right, yeah. Yes. We don't have one.
I'll put it on the floor. That's all right. I can't see you either, so go for it.
Keep leaning forward.
There's a table right there.
You.
Yeah.
That's all right. All right. We'll just put it down there. It'll be decorative. Anyway, back to my question.
Thank you. Not going back.
Why science-based as opposed to romance or, you know, spy stories
I'll
or whatever?
I'll get around there. One of these days. I grew up reading everything. You know, I was never I would say mostly genre writing. I wasn't reading a lot of literary fiction. I was reading mysteries, science fiction, horror. So anything in the genre field I was reading. And, you know, there's an old adage, music you liked in high school is a music you pretty much like the rest of your life. And I think it applies even for us authors, whatever stuff we like to read is pretty much what we want to write, at least you should. I always advocate that if a writer should be writing from a point of passion, you know, you should be excited about what you're writing, not, you know, chasing the market or doing anything like that. So this is what I love to read. And so I began writing. And I thought, well, they had a little bit of science, a little bit of history, a little mystery, a little bit of spy craft, a little bit of war thriller in there, to the point where I went to New York, I think about 7 books into my contract with HarperCollins, and I finally got to meet my editor for the first time. I never met my editor. She edited my first 7 books, never saw me. So I go to New York, I'm intimidated, because, you know, big, tall HarperCollins building, you're the top floor penthouse, you know, beautiful view of New York, long boardroom table. You know, the entire staff of HarperCollins is there. All the way to the end of the table is the man himself, Mike Morrison, who was running William Moore imprint at that point. And he stands up at the beginning of this introduction to myself and goes, you know, we've published a few books of yours, Jim, and just have one question. Yes, sir. What do you write? Well, I'm not really sure. Well, you published 7 books, I think you would know. So pretty much, you know, it is science-based, very leaning towards science. I think it's a lot of animals in my books. I have almost half my books that have main characters have animal sidekicks, whether it's a orphan jaguar cub or a wolf rescue dog or Baca, the Western mountain gorilla. Oh, yeah. I don't know if I ever answered your question, but I talked long enough. That classifies, right?
There was no right answer. It was just an interesting thing to explore. Now, twice that I know of, and I might have missed a beat, you have also written with a co-author. You wrote books
twice.
With Rebecca Cantrell,
right.
And then you wrote 2 of the Tucker Wayne books with Grant Sutherland.
And that's a good example, Grant Blackwood.
Sorry, Grant Blackwood, right.
And that's a good example of I read a lot of stuff. I had this idea for this vampire series, and I have never written a vampire book, and it was very gothic with a strong romantic through line through it, and I thought, well, you know, I write staccato space, you know, thrillers with Kowalski blowing things up. I'm not sure this really works. And so, but I've been a big fan of Rebecca since she was actually a student of mine in a teaching writing class, and had been reading her books, and she sets her mysteries between World War I and World War II, and they're historical mysteries, but she's very poetic. She's very good at just using a very lean writing style, but really being very evocative with her writing. I thought, well, this is just what it needs. I don't want it to be overly wordy type of story. I want it to still have that immediacy and pace, but I wanted that depth that she could bring to it. So I thought, well, gosh, maybe I bring my skills to the wheelhouse, and she could bring her skills to the wheelhouse, and we'll create something brand new, which is a great deal of fun.
So as an author, some authors really search for ideas, you know, or have long pauses. What was it, Thomas Harris? It was like 10 years between Silence of the Lambs and whatever. But you seem to be a person who's fizzing over with ideas, and so bringing in someone to help you do one.
That is a big problem. I am like that cat that sees the light that's bouncing around and you're chasing it. That's me.
Right.
That's me in my library room. I think I told the story before about how Map of Bones came about. Did I ever tell that story here? Maybe not.
Tell it again.
So in Map of Bones, the first sort of official book of the Sigma series, though Sigma was introduced in Sandstorm as a sort of ancillary support group to the main set of characters, so I would call that the prequel to the series. So I proposed to my editor, to spin this group into their first series. And I explained before why I was okay with doing a series for the first time with them, because it was based on a group. I can kill people off. It was great. And so I at that time, they required me to do detailed outlines of my stories. I had to, and by detail, I mean like 20 pages, single-spaced. The story had to be laid out to a T before they would actually pay me money. So I wrote the long thesis for the first of the Sigma books and turned it into my editor. She liked it, and they paid me, and I was happy to take their check from them. I went home, and then one Sunday morning I woke up and I thought, what if someone poisoned the communion wafers at a church? And then they pass the poison communion wafers during the Mass, everybody in the Mass dies. I like that. What am I going to do? Keep in mind, I was raised, you know, Roman Catholic and went to elementary school and junior high and Catholic school, so there's probably somewhere in their repressed memory why this came about, and it was a Sunday morning. And that got stuck in my head, and I couldn't let it go. This idea was there, and it was bright and shiny like a new penny, and I couldn't quite let it go. And I had this, you know, I had this contract, and I was already working on this story idea and bring it out to flesh, and I just couldn't let it go. And so I thought, well, maybe if I put it down in paper and at least get out of my head that way. So I sent my editor an email. It was just, you know, three sentences. I got this idea for you. In the next Sigma book, it'll be, you know, it's poison wafers. Everybody dies in the church. And I think there's one other line, like, cool. That was about it. And literally, I'm not exaggerating. Within 30 minutes, I get a response back from her. Yeah, write that one instead.
Possibly she too was raised in a parochial school.
They don't get the 20-page single-spaced outline. They get three sentences when I describe a novel. That's it.
Well, it's actually true of novels when they're new that publishers would like to know that you can finish the book, you know, complete the whole idea. So it's not unusual that they ask for outlines at the very beginning.
It shouldn't surprise her either. So, you know, I, like I said, this was several books into my contract with them at this point. And that was my process, is to turn in this long, detailed outline. And the books never matched the outline. And I would turn the book and they go, this is nothing like what you sent us. And I said, yeah, would you like it? Yeah, well, shut up. It was just a suggestion of that outline.
So the other thing I think that really is the hallmark of Jim's books, and which I like, are all the places that he takes you, the landscapes, and the things that he can explore. And I can remember, was it like 3 or 4 books ago, you and I were, as usual, out to dinner, and Jim is definitely ordering protein, no carbohydrates at this meal, you know, and I'm sort of
looking
at him. I
did order cookies back there, just so you know.
You did. And last night you had dessert. I saw the sticky toffee pudding, but nonetheless.
So good. Sticky toffee pudding at the Virtu, the restaurant over the corner from here.
Nonetheless, I did inquire, and he said that he was going on this diet, and, you know, maybe some of his health, but he also wanted to be able to go caving, I remember right,
yep,
in order to bring it into a book. And I thought, now here's a man who really lives his stories. You know, he's going to go on a serious diet, and he's going to go off and do that. And I thought,
that sounds really noble of me, but that was not the process.
No.
You know, it's a poorly kept secret that I started caving when I was in college.
Right.
Went to the University of Missouri, Columbia. Missouri is Cave Central, a lot of caves in that area. It's a great deal of fun to go caving. Wild caves, explore something no one's ever seen. I'm there. But as I got older and my knees came a little more ricketer, my waistline got a little bit wider, and I got, you know, crossed the 50 age mark, I thought, you know, maybe I started weaning down. My caving went from like every month to every other month to maybe next year. But I was still belonging to the same grotto, the same Haven Club that I belonged to, and they, every month they would have a guest speaker that would bring a slideshow of his the cave that he was in and did, and talk about the technical aspects of the cave. And this gentleman came up and gave this long talk about the very technical, very hard cave, and very impressed that they were able to get down to the bottom of it. And this gentleman was 65 years old.
Oh, wow.
So I'm thinking, okay, I can't keep making up this excuse anymore. Sounded good, but if I was guilted into it, basically shamed into losing weight to build the cave again.
So 50's the
so
new.
So it sounded
30,
good.
You know,
sounded,
I
she
mean.
Said. I like her explaining. She said the truth. That was just made up. What she said was true. The noble author, staying in shape to bring adventure to you all.
Love it. So in this new book that we're here to talk about tonight, Demon Crown, there's some wonderful scenes in Tallinn, Estonia. And last night at dinner, we were talking about Tallinn, and I was telling, my husband is like a dowser for great restaurants. Wherever he goes, with absolutely no plan or whatever, Rob will find the best restaurant, literally fall into them sometimes or whatever. And I'd forgotten when we were talking last night that you've got, you know,
it's a small
talent. I know, but it's still, you know, fun to do that. However, I'm reasonably sure that the island that you describe off the coast of Brazil is not a place you've actually been.
No, that's not been there. Has anybody read the book yet? You've all read it, right? Is that
of
only
course.
Been out like
yeah.
what an hour?
Yeah. Speed readers.
Right.
I'm not going to read it. It's the first chapter, so it's probably if you're writing the teasers, you probably read it. But there's actually an island off the coast of Brazil that is full of deadly snakes. And no one's allowed to go on that island except for the Brazilian Navy is allowed to go there to monitor it. At one point, they had a lighthouse on the island and a lighthouse keeper's family. They lasted like 2 nights, and then the whole entire family, mom, dad, and 2 kids, were killed trying to escape these poisonous snakes. There's like one of these snakes for every yard. You'll find one of these snakes on the island. And they're extremely toxic, really deadly. So of course, you know, I'm going there. Not me personally, but my story's going there.
Now, in case you think that is something that Jim has just made up, I don't know if any of you have watched, and I'm trying to remember what it's streaming on, but there's a fabulous thing called Blue Pacific. I think it's 7 parts. It's absolutely amazing, and there is a similar island off China.
Oh, really?
Yep, and what happens is that something or other has isolated these islands from the mainland. In Jim's book, I think it was
a land bridge originally.
A land bridge.
Got flooded,
right.
And so the snakes were isolated. And because they only prey with birds, and the normally this toxic was chasing things that you can kill, wait for you know, for the scurrying little rodent to die, and then you can kill it. Well, birds could fly. So they had to develop a more toxic venom because they need to kill a bird more quickly. That's why these snakes are so particularly venomous.
Right. So if you actually want to watch this in action, because it's the same thing, and I don't remember the name of the Chinese island, the snakes are dormant all year until the bird migration and the birds. Now, you would really think that if the birds are truly into it with evolution, that the message would go out, don't stop on this island while you're flying, but somehow they do. And there's some really dramatic and fairly repulsive scenes of the snakes. You know, the bird will be out there and the snake twined around the limb or, you know, whatever, and striking. So I thought it was interesting. I had to do a moment of geography to say, I wonder if this is Jim's island. I think Brazil, Atlantic Ocean, can't be Blue Pacific, right? Yeah, so there are actually two of these islands.
There is. I didn't know the one that off China, but the one off Brazil is real.
Well, it's fascinating. So
and I can't pronounce it. You know, they call it Snake Island. I could pronounce that.
Right. But in both instances, their primary food source, in fact, at this point, having killed everything else that had survived there, is birds flying in and then flying away. So that's just one of the components that goes to make up this story. Talk to me a little bit about amber, because amber is a truly fascinating substance, and it comes into play very early in the book.
It does. Do you know what I'm carrying in my pocket here?
Do you actually have a piece of amber with you?
I was all prepared for where do you get your idea question.
Not for
saving,
me.
I was saving this until the Q&A, because I knew that was going to come up. One of you were going to ask it, so I was prepared for the answer this time.
Okay.
And this is true. This is where the idea for this book came from.
Right.
Now, as I've mentioned before, I always collect a weird assortment of ideas for my idea book. One of the bases for this was an article about from Homeland Security about one of the big threats they're worried about, which is what if somebody weaponizes an invasive species and releases them in the U.S.? that is a major concern because it's hard to guard against that. Everybody's familiar with the pythons in Florida or the Asian carp in the lakes that are competing with the native fish populations. Once one of these foreign species gets in there, it's hard to get rid of. Now, the pythons and the carp were accidental. They were accidental contaminations of an environment. But Homeland Security is worried about what if a hostile power weaponizes. So that was in my idea box for a long period of time. The history, which I might go into in a little bit, was also in my idea box because it deals with the origin or how the Smithsonian got started. Now, where is Sigma Force located? In bunkers beneath the Smithsonian Castle, so I had in my back pocket some of the mysteries surrounding the founding of the Smithsonian Institution. So that was in the box. But where the idea came from, since you ruined my thing again, I was all prepared for the Q&A, where are your ideas from? Everybody turn around. No, I'll turn around just a second. This takes a little preparation.
Okay.
So this is giving you an idea how weird. Remember how weird it is? I have no idea where my ideas come from because they just out of the blue pop out of nowhere. Cat chasing light. Me waking up. Let's murder people in church.
So while Jim's doing that, this is a moment to tell you that HarperCollins, his publisher, has been wonderful about creating an extra collectible that you get with your book when you come to Jim's launch parties here. And so this one, you've got a picture of the Smithsonian, the old one in your book. And the Smithsonian is not only the place where Sigma is, but as Jim said.
Cool, huh?
Oh, look.
Everybody stop looking. Cat light, all of you. See? Anything that's shiny. So this has been sitting on my desk for years. And I got it when we were in, oddly enough, in Tallinn, because there's a major, so the Amber Road. There's a major Amber Road that goes from St. Petersburg all the way down to Venice. An old, sort of like the old Silk Road. And so I got this in Tallinn. And it's been sitting on my desk for years. And eventually I got looking at it a little closer. And if you look, and you can see this when you come up and get your book signed. Hence, clever. Now you have to come up here to see it closer. And there's a monetary attachment to that product. But if you look really closely, there is actually a little bee or a little wasp trapped in that amber. And so that became the basis of this book, is what if that was still alive and somehow? And what if that was really dangerous? And, you know, we read about parasitic wasps and all the icky things those things can do. What fun. So this is, like I said, probably one of my most gruesome novels I've ever written, mostly because somewhere in this book you're going to see Kowalski's naked butt. So be prepared. How that happens, I'm not going to tell you. But
fortunately, there are only maps in the book and not actual sketches of Kowalski's butt, so that will make you happy.
No, there is. I'm not joking. I'm not talking about a description of Kowalski's butt. You're going to see Kowalski's butt in this book.
So for those of you who might not actually know the origin of Amber...
I'll give you the page number if you want to look it up.
Well, I read the advanced reading copy, and they didn't put all that fancy stuff in there.
No, they didn't have all the pictures
in
my advanced reading copy.
Tell us about what the actual composition of Amber is that allows it to wind up encasing things like the bee.
Yeah, when you hear about it, pick it up. It's really light. Because basically this is just a resin sap that solidifies over the years. And there's a lot of history about amber that's in this book about, you know, how old is amber? Where's the oldest amber come from? What's the history of amber? Did you know that the breastplate of Tutankhamun has pieces of Baltic amber? Amber from the Baltic is in Tutankhamun's breastplate. Again, that was indicating that there was a trade route still from the Baltic Sea all the way down to ancient Egypt, to the point where Tutankhamun had chunks of Baltic amber in his chest plate.
So if you go to St. Petersburg on some kind of a tour, you can see the... It's not the original Amber Room because that was taken away, as many of you may know, by the Nazis in the war. Nobody really knows what's happened to it, but they've recreated it. But because of its beautiful translucent quality, you can imagine that if they were hosting things in the Amber Room with candlelight and so forth, how absolutely gorgeous this whole thing would have been. I went to a concert in the Katharinenhof where the Amber Room is located, and it glows in just a gorgeous way.
It is a pretty... They don't let you touch it. I tried to touch it in the room. They didn't like that. Hermitage, can I touch this? No. Those babushkas.
I didn't point the fact. Unlike diamonds, where, you know, if there's a flaw inside or something, it detracts from it, amber can actually be more valuable if there's some cool little thing that, because it's tree sap, you know, has been incorporated into it. So it's perfect for your purposes, right?
Exactly. So that's, now you know where I got my ideas from. So you don't have to ask it. It's done. We can all leave now.
So the final thing that we could talk about, because it's chapter 4, so it's not going to be a Yellowstone moment, is if there is, in fact, a, for those of you who don't know about Yellowstone, we'll tell you later. If you were going to weaponize something, what country would that be, and why would they want to do that? And I really loved your the way you created, but you got there by steps, because there are two scenes back in time before we get to the present, right, in the book, right?
Yep.
And the second one, when you read it, you will see why this particular person and country decides to weaponize, well, what does it weaponize? It's a very cool thing.
Yeah. You know, basically, it's again, the idea for this is that I read an article about how Japan really doesn't like us. There's still a lot of resentment following World War II in Japan. Is even though there are allies, there's still a large portion of them that don't particularly care for Americans. And so, again, I was just wondering if, you know, what if somebody tried to repeat Pearl Harbor, but maybe a biological version thereof? What might happen.
Right.
So that became, again, where the story began to build.
So one of the things I really love about it, because I, at one point in my past life, was a librarian at the Library of Congress, is that the hero of the second part of the book, the introductory chapter, is actually a man who was the Librarian of Congress, yep, at the time, and who had some very serious duties during the Second World War, one of which was, well, you tell them. It's your story.
Right. It's sort of fascinating that one of the goals during World War II was to protect our national treasures. And so the Library of Congress at that point wanted to build a big bunker under the National Mall and store everything under there. But Congress said, no, it's too expensive. We're not going to do that. So basically, they had to distribute all of our national treasures. They hid the Star-Spangled Banner in the Shenandoah Forest. They took the Gutenberg Bible and took it to Fort Knox. They took all the treasures and spread them out and hid them at different places in case there was should ever be attack in D.C. So that, again, became a part of the story. I'm not ruining anything that's happened right at the beginning of the novel.
It does. So that was pretty fun.
I'm not ruining anything. What happens at the end, though, is this. I'm afraid Barbara will finish that sentence, so
I will
continue
not.
On.
No. I've learned my lesson with Yellowstone. Not going to do that. I like the fact that there's so many of the team in play, and they're all doing different things. So, you know, you really have to keep track of a pretty large cast, sending them out, deploying them here and there.
Yeah, generally I have, like, you know, two locations, or sometimes three, depending upon the actual set piece. I enjoy that because I just like to torture you people, so I can cliffhang one scene with one group of characters and say, you're not going to find out what happens with them until you read this boring section right over here. I'm clever that way.
Now I can see that you really have a lot of... How many of have a particular character that you bond with rather than the whole team? Is there any one person that you like the best? I see nods. So, right. And I think that's an interesting thing about having a team, Sigma Force, rather than just one player, is that you can identify with different characters.
I mean, again, I explained this before about the Jessica Fletcher syndrome. How many people have heard me talk before? You've heard the Jessica Fletcher syndrome before. Who hasn't heard about the Jessica Fletcher syndrome? Okay, come over here. About six of you, gather really quickly. Jessica Fletcher was from Murder, She Wrote. You know, here's an old woman that was stumbling over a dead body every single week. Eventually you begin to, it's hard, you know, your suspension of disbelief becomes strained. Why is this woman always stumbling over dead bodies? You know, if the last revelation of the series was that she was a serial killer, then it makes sense. You know, she's framing people all along. And also, as much as, you know, in some episode, if somebody puts a gun against Jessica Fletcher's head, you know they're never going to pull that trigger because she's going to be next week's episode. So what's the fun of that? So I resisted doing series for a long period of time until I got this idea of doing a series based on a group, because at that point, the jeopardy can come from many different directions. Nobody's safe, because Sigma can always recruit a new member to replace them, so that when I do put people in jeopardy, they want to be, you know, if I put a gun against somebody's head, I want to think, he might chop off Monk's hand.
Just thinking that.
I'm not rooting that. It's from way long ago.
He's just recalling it to your memory because it might actually have a function in the book. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about Demon Force, or rather talk about a little bit, is Joseph Smithson, because he's a really fascinating character. He who, in fact, donated the money and so forth to create the Smithsonian.
He donated by dying. So James Smithson was a British chemist slash geologist. Upon his death, they read his will and testament and found out that he left his entire fortune to this young nation that he'd never set foot in. Never ever has been to America, but he wanted to found this great institution of higher learning and scientific study. Wanted to be named after him, so he donated this great amount of his estate, including a vast mineral collection to the United States. And there's some mystery surrounding this little figure, mostly because during the Civil War, there was a fire that broke out in the Smithsonian Castle, ended up destroying almost all of his personal papers and writings and diaries and field notebooks. So almost nothing's known about his abilities as a scientist because they were erased by that fire. And to add even more to the mystery is that about a century after his death, Alexander Graham Bell snuck across the Atlantic over to Italy. Genoa, Italy is where James Smithson was buried. Snowy New Year's Eve, cracks open that tomb, takes the bones of James Smithson, puts it in a zinc coffin, takes it back across the Atlantic, and that's where his bones are now residing in the Smithsonian Castle. A lot of skullduggery involved, literally in this case, with Alexander Graham Bell. The Smithsonian Regents didn't want him to go get those bones. When he was there, he had to lie, he bribed people. He told everybody that President Roosevelt at that time was the one that sent him to get those bones. Didn't. So, you know, me as a thriller writer, I think, what's going on with this guy that he's that important that the inventor of the telephone is sneaking off in the middle of the night to steal his bones? And then, so there's other little cryptic things that are in the book. I don't want to give too much away, so I'll leave the rest a mystery.
And there was another fire, too, wasn't there, that erased his... mineral collection?
Yeah, same fire destroyed the mineral collection.
Right, so for whatever bizarre reason, the Smithsonian Institute has had two catastrophic fires. Who would know? But, you know, I was thinking about you and your Catholic heritage because this whole scenario about Alexander Graham Bell going to Genoa and cracking open the tomb, that actually happened. The Venetians sent a team to Egypt where St. Mark was buried. And they, in fact, did that. They cracked open the tomb and they smuggled him onto a ship and they brought him to Venice, which is why St. Mark's in Venice is there, and they buried him there. So, in fact, Ellis Peters wrote a book like that. Any of you who've read Historical Mystery and A Morbid Taste for Bones, she has a raid, I think it's into Wales, if I remember it right, but stealing, you know, the bones of a person and bringing them to rebury them somewhere is not...
I've only done that once.
Right. But it's not original, so there. So one last thing before we open this up to questions. Tell us what you are working on for 2018.
I think I mentioned this last time that I was going to do an anthology of all the short stories that are scattered across different media. It's all going to be one book, but I'm adding a novella, a 140-page story featuring Tucker and a certain four-legged friend. Yes. You'll be seeing that pairing again in the new anthology, and then I have a new Sigma book, which I don't want to go in great length about, but it's cool.
Well, it was actually...
And it deals with Catholicism in a very weird way, that's all I'll say.
I just thought you all liked to hear the good news about Tucker, because I really like him, and, you know, he can have a great novella adventure. So part of it, if I remember right, part of the story takes place in... Something in the book takes place in Sedona.
It does. If those that follow me on Facebook know that I went to Sedona early this year, that was for research for that book.
Yeah.
But I also went to the Sunset Crater out there, and it was sort of cool because I went over there to pay my admission into the thing. I'm waiting in line to pay my ticket, and I get to the front of the line, and the ward, the state person, goes, "Hey, are you James Rollins?" I go, "No way! Yeah, we've all read your book since you said it here. I did get everything wrong? No. Well, good. Just, can I have that in writing?" It's a great deal of fun to be reckoned. The only time it ever happens.
I think it's fabulous. Now, I would like to thank our Facebook audience for joining us, and we are going to sign off.
Before we do that, let me just pass a quick shout out to Jerry Zaveda, who runs the Sigma Force Base Camp, and to not done yet.
We're cheering for him.
and Claire Summer Davies, who runs the UK Sigma headquarters. So thank you. Thank everybody for supporting us on Facebook and abroad.
And I will remind you again that you can go to our website and share the Facebook interview to your own website or tell people all about it. I see something coming our way. What could this be? Oh, look.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
This was somebody from Seattle sent this to us to enjoy today. It's
That's
a little
bun
cake with a little crown on it. Thank you, Linda. I appreciate it.
We're at
Linda,
the end.
Linda Moore Sanders.
Oh, how
and her puppies and her daughter,
Look
Vanessa.
At that. So should we eat it or let everybody have a photo with it?
You can photo with it. I said we just eat it with our hands.
Fabulous. All right. I'm going